Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. Brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
So we've kind of mapped out the basic here that it depends on whether, you know, actually this problem is also faced in the West. I was just in Australia this summer, talking to them about the abortion issue, which of course is something grappled with all around the world. And in a country where the Christian population influence is about 2%.
That's right.
Very, very small. And it is a post-Christian, very much kind of post-modernish kind of culture, very much in the minority, absolutely next to no chance of having any structural political influence because of the lack of numbers, et cetera. The way in which to approach a social issue like abortion is limited by where they find themselves.
That's right.
I'm bringing up that example to show that it isn't that the minority majority issue is almost bigger than the East West or two thirds world majority world non majority world contrast. Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about how cultural engagement is different when you are a significant minority. Let's start there, because I think that's what Christians here sometimes may have a hard time getting their hands around.
Yeah. But let me start first, Daryl, if you don't mind, with that similarity part.
Okay.
Because I think it is important that we understand that Christians everywhere are going to be salt and light.
Right.
You know, that's what we're called to do. We're called to be salt and light within our cultures, no matter where we are. So that's sort of the commonality. That's the biblical injunction that we can take forward. But given that, the question is, how do we do that within our culture? And that's, of course, where the differences are. And I think that my, I don't say I'm a disappointment, but it might be, to use that word, my disappointment is that sometimes Christians in North America think about cultural engagement in a way that is simply, and they think this is the way that Christians should do it all around the world, but without a recognition that the context is different. And their way of thinking about Christian engagement with the culture is not going to work in India. It's not going to work in Egypt. It's not going to work in Latin America, because the context is so radically different. And it may be that the way they're thinking about it in terms of, and oftentimes it has to do with political engagement, because of the fact that they have a majority and within a democratic society, they're able to work through that political process to try to accomplish, as it were, an agenda which they think fits their Christian worldview. That, my friend, is not going to work in India. And so one wonders whether Christians, even within the West, shouldn't be thinking, is this really the best way to engage Christian culture or engage culture from a Christian point of view? Or are there other ways? Are there other ways we can think of and perhaps learn from in those areas, those cultures that are not dominated by Christian thinking, and yet there are Christians there who are living out their Christian life?
And of course, the reality is I think we're learning as we move from election to election.
That's right.
That the numbers here are not such that you can dictate an agenda.
That's right.
And so the question becomes, how do you function as salt and light in the context in which there is going to be a resistance and opposition and challenge to what it is you're going to want to put on the table? I think that it just so happens that right now I'm working in Matthew 10, which is on mission, and a lot of that chapter of Matthew is dealing with how do you engage in a mission in which there are going to be a lot of people who don't like what you're saying.
That's right.
And there's going to be rejection. There's going to even be hostility. Of course, we see a little bit of that now and then. And so how do you deal with those challenges, whether you think you have numbers or not? I actually think that one of the mistakes we make in cultural engagement is to see cultural engagement as being – I'm going to make a contrast here that's going to sound stronger than I intended, but it's the only way to picture it. Do we deal from a position in which we claim to have power, or do we deal from a position in which we claim to serve our society? That's the contrast I want to put out on the table.
And I think that's an excellent contrast. And so what has happened, I think, in the West, and particularly North America, is that through terms such as culture wars, mm-hmm. We think in terms of power.
Right.
And we think that in order to win this war, we need to exercise our power within the culture. And within a democracy such as we have here, that often means power at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. But as you said, that, quote, power continues to diminish within North America. And so the question is, is this really the best way to frame our thinking about cultural engagement, is to think about culture wars and power? Or are there different ways in which we can think about cultural engagement, ways in which Christians for millennia have been operating uh-huh. in situations out of weakness and a minority position? And that, I think, is something that we might look at in terms of the growing trends within the West.
Okay, so go there. What do those look like? What can we learn from what you see around the world in terms of the way engagement can function? What are the other models or frames around which we can place Christian involvement that also at the same time show the potential and power of what it is that Christians are about in the gospel?
Yeah. Darrell, have you read James Hunter's book, Change the World to Change the World?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that's sort of a book that I read about a year ago, and I continue to reflect on, and in a positive way, in the sense that what he's talking about there, and we can summarize that in a minute, mm-hmm. but what he's talking about there does seem to describe and provide a conceptual framework for thinking about cultural engagement in settings where, as I've described, Christians are a minority, even a persecuted minority, and don't have the power, the political power, to accomplish their agendas.
Mm-hmm.
That framework that he lays out it resonates with me. And I wonder if that's not, if you would ask me, where would I go in terms of cultural engagement? Some of the ways that he's framed that that discussion might be helpful.
Like?
You know, what Hunter says, if I can describe him or summarize him accurately, mm-hmm. is that some of the things I've been saying about trying to accomplish a Christian agenda through the political process or through power structures may not be our primary objective.
Mm-hmm.
It may come about just as we live our Christian lives, but that would be a secondary outcome rather than a primary objective. And that's an important distinction to make.
Okay. And the other thing that it seems to me is in play here is thinking through how do Christians be Christians and serve well. If I can think about, you know, when I look at the biblical exhortations of, say, an epistle like 1 Peter, where it's talking about life as a Christian in the context in which obviously Christians were a terrific minority in the first century. Basically, his exhortation is be a good citizen.
Absolutely.
Live well with those around you. Serve faithfully. Engage ethically. It's just basically looking to see where you can be a positive influence on that which is going on around you and contribute in such a way that people see the value of who you are as a human being and maybe, to use the words of Matthew, you know, might see your good works and glorify the Father in heaven. So is that the kind of direction that we're talking about and that the kind of emphasis that we're seeing?
I think it is, yeah. And that quote, by the way, that they might see your good works and glorify God who is in heaven, in 1 Peter, actually, you have a very similar situation, mm-hmm. that they might see your good works and glorify God on the day that he visits us.
That's right.
So the same idea is there. The other passage I think of is 1 Timothy chapter 2,
mm-hmm.
when Paul exhorts, he begins with the pray for all people.
Right.
And especially kings and those in authority.
Mm-hmm.
This is why. Because this pleases God, who desires all men to come to a knowledge of the truth. For there's one God and one mediator, Jesus Christ, who himself is human. And then Paul says, for this very reason, I was made a herald, an apostle, one who proclaims the gospel to the nations. And so what Paul does there is he looks at that exclusivity of what God has done in Christ and says, because of that, we have an inclusive mission to pray and to proclaim. And match that together with what you're saying in 1 Peter, to live out our lives in a way that they might see our good works and glorify God. That it begins at that personal level of discipleship, of what we're doing in our family life and what we're doing in our congregational life. That's where it begins. So how do we live out our lives in a way that people will see that light in the midst of darkness?
Now, you know, what's interesting is we did a podcast recently with Andy Crouch talking about culture making, mm-hmm. and this was his emphasis too, that really we tend to go global and political when perhaps we ought to think more local about our influence and how we can influence the things that we're more directly in many ways involved with. And it's a similar kind of emphasis in some ways. So how does, again, learning from what you see globally, when you look at what's going on globally, are there models of that kind of engagement that you see that you can share with us that might be helpful in helping people kind of flesh out what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think that is the what we see happening in those kind of contexts, where Christians are being faithful to what God has called them to be. And if God has called them to be a businessman, then they're being faithful within that context. If God has called them to be a teacher, they're being faithful before their students. And faithful, I think, means several things. It means living out the Christian life in a way that's open for other people to see, and also to be competent in what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you do, do it for the glory of God. So they're doing it well. They're not being sloppy. They're not being lazy. They're being diligent. They're competent, and with that focus in mind, this is part of being a testimony to Christ within the area that they're called. If they are called to civil service, if they all are called to government or to a life in military, they live out their Christian experience within those contexts, and that I think is a way that. That is, it happens in every culture.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen in every culture.
Mm-hmm.
And without thinking of the, well, we have to take over this political structure, or we have to change this particular way of power engagement.
So just as an example, I think of the person who, say, is a, I'll give a hard example. I know this happens in the Middle East. You've got a Christian who's either in politics or in the army.
Yep.
Obviously, the country's concerns are are not being driven by the church.
Right.
How does a person function in that context? When you were talking about this kind of a model, what are they doing? What are they looking at? How are they thinking about it?
It's a hard question. Maybe I need to step into their shoes and really deal with the issues at hand. And I think that sometimes there may be tremendous conflicts between what they see as their Christian values,
mm-hmm.
And yet in those situations around them, there are values that are very contrary
mm-hmm.
To what's happening. I can think of several testimonies I've heard of. For instance, a Chinese Christian who there was influence on him to cover up certain kinds of corruption, certain kinds of things that were happening within the manufacturing plant that was in China. But as a believer, he said he couldn't do that, he wanted to be above that. And because of that, he lost his job. But he maintained his Christian testimony. Later on, of course, God used that mm-hmm. in the lives of other people so that other people came to know Christ through that example. So in those kind of contexts, that's not going to be an easy thing, because a lot of times those values around you
are in conflict.
Yeah. Whereas here in the West, we may feel comfortable because the choices we make to live out a Christian life may not meet that same kind of resistance. Whereas in the situations you're talking about, in the Middle East, for instance, when a soldier is in military or somebody who's in government may find that there's more and more conflict, but yet to retain that Christian witness becomes such an important part of what it is to be a Christian.
So how are the schools, you said there are some courses that deal with helping civil servants and that kind of thing. What kinds of courses are those, and what are they doing? How are they helping their students face what they're going to face?
Yeah. Think of schools in Singapore, for instance. Seminaries there, the traditional seminary, of course, that has for many years trained, focused on pastors, on teachers, and so forth, but then began to see openings within the broader church context of businessmen who also wanted to learn about scriptures and wanted to learn about how to live their Christian life within a business context, within the business world. And the point here is there's integration. That is, our Christian life is not segmented into what we do on Sunday, what we do in our family, what we do in our church, and then there's also what we do in our business, but that's different than what we're doing on Sunday mornings. So how do we actually bring integration within that? And I think that's the kind of course that these seminaries are offering. So they're approaching these businessmen in Singapore. They're meeting over the lunch hour, and talking about their experience as Christian businessmen, and dealing with some very important issues that are about how to live out that Christian life. What does it mean ethically to overcome those tendencies toward corruption, for instance, that you might find? What does it mean to give your employees a fair wage and fair benefits and to live Christianly in that way? What does it mean to use the resources that God has given you through the profits, for instance, of your company, and use those for the glory of God by investing them in the church, investing them in missions, investing them in centers where more leaders can be trained? Those are the kind of things that are being discussed, and I think that there's a real hunger for that among Christians in those countries that haven't seen an integration of their Christian life, their Christian worldview, with what they do 40 hours a week.
So we get these emphasis on integration, and we get the emphasis on service and thinking through that. We've talked a little bit about the challenges of what happens in a situation where you're a minority. Let's flip it again and talk about now where places where the Christian presence is broader, it's more pervasive, but you still have this tension that the world and the way in which it operates oftentimes isn't quite exactly what the way Christians would see things, and the tensions that you have. What advice, you've said that there's a consistency across all this in terms of how to think about it, but the situation that we do have here is a little bit different. You're not 2%. There is the opportunity to engage. There's the freedom and the right to engage. In some of the countries where we've talked about, you don't have those freedoms and those rights. So how do you see what you've seen and learned overseas applying to the situation in which there might be the opportunity to have meaningful conversations across the whole swath of life? Does it change very much, or are the values pretty much the same? What differences make a difference, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I'm not sure I I'm going to answer your question specifically, Daryl, and if I don't, bring me back.
Okay.
But I'm thinking about a situation in India, for instance, where, as you know, corruption is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that the church believes it can speak into the culture in a way that that the culture might understand and value the Christian voice in this particular discussion.
So there's a contribution. I'm going to use a phrase that we see in the West a lot in a lot of these discussions. There's a contribution to the common good of the well-being of the society that the church is trying to step into, and
that's
how they're approaching the question.
That's right. That's right, exactly. And so they would hold conferences, for instance, on issues of corruption, where they're able to gather together business leaders, non-Christian mm-hmm. often, business leaders, those in the military, those in government, to talk about issues of corruption. And the reason that they're able to bring them together is because all of the culture is concerned about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're concerned when there's a building that they build for the Commonwealth Games that collapses and people die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're wondering, okay, now did the contractor take a shortcut on this? This is not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're concerned when there's huge black holes in the government where money just disappears. They don't want that. And so they're able to gather them together and then provide a Christian voice into this topic. And that, I think, is something that that Christians all over the world are seeing as possibilities, where Christians have positive things to say, to speak into the culture from their own values and vantage point, from a Christian framework, that the culture around them will say, well, you know, that's something that we would also agree with,
mm-hmm.
That we would value. We value those things. And that's a positive contribution that can be made.
Now, the harder situation, of course, is when the value that the Christian has is not necessarily in line with where the culture is going. And we
That's right.
have seen that obviously illustrated in a whole variety of areas in our context today. But that doesn't change the calling in some sense. It may change the dynamics of the calling. But again, the tension that I see here, let me see if I can make this a clearer question. The tension that I see here is, what do you do when the values in the conversation are mixed?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's often said today is that when it comes to monetary issues and business issues and materialism issues and that kind of thing in the West, that oftentimes you get a sense that a Christian is defending a certain kind of economic model as opposed to whether or not that economic model actually works in delivering to people all that we might hope mm-hmm. a society would deliver to people. I'm trying to do this
right.
as non-politically as possible, and it may be hard to do. And my sense is that sometimes Christians are accused of having values that line up more with a political ideology or an economic ideology than they do necessarily with Christian values. And so I'll go ahead and say it, medical care, which of mm-hmm. course is a huge debated area because of what it means for entitlements and the cost of it, et cetera. But on the one hand, you sit there and say, who doesn't want to create a society in which people can get basic medical care and whether they can afford it or not, that human beings are taken care of?
Right.
So you have this tension between what economically might be viable and the human value of reaching out to a person in need and extending compassion to them and being sure that they're cared for. How do you wrestle through those tensions? And does what you have seen overseas help us with that? And the reason I ask that question is because in my own experience, which has mostly involved Europe, the battles that we get into on an area, say, like medical care, most Europeans have trouble mm-hmm. identifying with because they assume that the human value, they'll even use Christian value,
mm-hmm.
is to make sure that people are cared for. What do you see in that kind of area where I could say the values are mixed and you're prioritizing a mixture of values?
I'm trying to think of another situation besides medical care in the U.S., for instance, can you think of a particular issue in a different context, in a non-Western context where that might be an issue? I know there are those things. I'm just trying to get a handle
think
on
of what it might be. Yeah. I think that one of the examples that you gave that shows at least the intent are these agricultural and fishery programs, mm-hmm. in which you're actually trying to help people move to care for themselves, but where the initial extended hand, if I can say it that way, the initial extended hand is to make sure they're being cared for. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're trying to accomplish multiple objectives at the same time. And to teach, you know, it's interesting to teach pastors to have those kinds of skills, mm-hmm. is a kind of integration to, mm-hmm. put together what you've talked about, that normally in our thinking we would distinguish, we would segregate from one another. And so I see the driving of a value, and this goes back to the model, I see the driving of a value to serve and to step into the situation in a way that makes clear what the effort to meet human needs are, mm-hmm. in a healthy way, determining and prioritizing what goes around it, mm-hmm. if I can say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And those efforts to foster development and to step in and bring a situation in which development can happen seems to me to have those priorities right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I get the drift of what where you're going on this. I think part of it is an awareness on the part of the church as to what the priority issues are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that many of our churches unfortunately have blinders in terms of the main cultural issues that are going around them, and they tend to either be simply those. And I don't mean to be pejorative here, but it seems, just from my sense,
mm-hmm.
that they tend to, whatever issues are around there, there's a sense of either denial,
mm-hmm.
that those issues are going on, but they're not important to us, or they're just making those up,
mm-hmm.
Or there's a sense that whatever we see in the world, the church is contrary to those, and so there's a sense of no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're the party of no.
And we're not going to partner with anybody in anything that involves a global effort, because obviously the global effort's wrong.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And so part of it is a matter of awareness. Can we actually open our eyes and see broader than the four walls of our church, of our congregation, to see what's actually happening in the world around us? And so, for instance, you would have, let me take a few examples here, a seminary in Manila,
mm-hmm.
that offers programs, typical programs for their pastors, trained pastors and teachers and so forth. But you ask them, well, you know, a lot of Manila lives in poverty. How are you preparing your pastors to deal with issues of poverty that they're going to find in their contexts? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, that's something that we really haven't thought about. Now, I'm not saying there is a particular seminary in Manila like that.
I think
most of them have begun to deal with those issues. But here's an issue that the culture around them is screaming. You know, this is a huge issue for us. What does the church have to say in a positive way that can contribute toward helping us deal with this issue of poverty?
You know, I've got two examples in my own life leap immediately to mind. When I was doing spiritual formation work with our spiritual groups, I would purposely take our students just a couple of blocks across the street. And this is at a time when Dallas was made up slightly differently, although there's still some of this now. But the seminary in the 80s and 90s was located in the midst of what most people would say were some of the worst environment in Dallas. But there were all kinds of women's shelters and outreach things.
Right.
And the point that I would take them there and show them these agencies and say, here are agencies in our context that are trying to help people who are in terrific need. And we would simply go and say, an hour a week, every other week, you know, how can we help you? And my point was to say, you don't need to create a Christian organization to do this. There are organizations right here doing this into which you can step and volunteer and be of service. That's one example. The second example I think of is in Guatemala, mm-hmm. at Sateca. Sateca is located literally blocks from the garbage dump that literally you can watch. If you go, I go every mm-hmm. 2 years up until recently, and you can literally watch the garbage dump move across this ravine and cover it. But there were kids mm-hmm. living in that garbage dump, and there was a program, and I don't remember who I think it was World Vision, mm-hmm. ran an orphanage school in the garbage. It literally was mm-hmm. located on the edge of the garbage dump, and seminary students from Sateca were going and were part of the volunteer workforce that stepped into that place, and they were helping there. Right. So it was your example of what are you doing to help with the poverty. There also were courses in circumstances in which they were teaching their students how to minister in contexts where there weren't many resources, that kind of thing. And in fact, one of the things that we did with that group was, in fact, the reason I was there is we taught a class in which we took North American students from Dallas and from Denver. The person that I mm-hmm. taught it with teaches Old Testament at Denver, Danny Carroll, and he still does this. And he would take a swath of students down, and we'd mix them with the Latin American students. The class would be bilingual, some in Spanish, some in English. And the one assignment that the American students had was this: talk about how you would read the Bible differently if you lived here versus where you live in North America.
That's right.
And of course, they were only there 2 weeks, but what immediately became clear from what we showed them and where the seminary was located and the garbage dump being called, and we took them into the garbage dump so they could see what life was like for someone living mm-hmm. in that context. What immediately became clear to them is that all these theoretical passages on poverty mm-hmm. weren't so theoretical anymore. Right. It was in their face.
That's right.
And that produced an awareness and a sensitivity. Virtually everyone we took on that trip would come back and say, I'm not the same person, and I'm not reading the Bible in entirely the same way. Not in a negative mm-hmm. sense, very much in a positive sense of, I am sensitive to things now I was never sensitive to before I made the trip.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a great example of awareness. When I think of these issues, I think usually of three words, and mm-hmm. I think I've probably mentioned them throughout mm-hmm. this conversation already, but if I just highlight them. The first one is awareness. Mm-hmm. The second one is intentionality. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be intentional about actually providing those kinds of experiences or that kind of teaching, that kind of information.
And moving in direction of those kinds of services.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So intentionality. And the third one would be, and now I've forgotten what. No, the third one is integration. Uh-huh. So that they see that when we're talking about the text and the context, the word and the world, you know, the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other, as Karl Barth would say, the double listening, mm-hmm. as John Stott would say. We listen to the word and we listen to the world. Not in the same way, of course,
right?
But we still are open to hear those voices. And how do we integrate that within our training as we train those who would lead congregations? And then how, of course, are they going to be leading their congregations in a way that has those three components as well?
And when I think about awareness, what I also think about is the impact of if I can say it, a mentality. There's a mentality that the awareness... We're not aware in some cases because we have blinders. We're also not aware sometimes because we're not willing to think about how might I approach this differently than I have in the past, mm-hmm. or what ought I to be sensitive to that perhaps I haven't been sensitive to in the past, that kind of thing. And one of the reasons for having this particular conversation on cultural engagement and getting a global perspective on things and asking the questions the way that I have is because I'm trying to picture for people who may never have traveled outside the United mm-hmm. States or that kind of thing, how life in a different world, in a different context, does create different sensitivities and different awarenesses. Mm-hmm. And out of those different awarenesses, there are sensitivities that are created that make you think differently. But we're talking about a biblically different kind of thinking. We're not talking about just different thinking. It's not something to be afraid of. It's something to actually reflect upon and embrace.
It is. And we think of how we read the text. Also, as we read scriptures, as you said, people having experienced that would read the text differently. And you, of course, would be familiar from Luke 10 of the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting experiment, Daryl, if you would do this. You ask people here in the West to retell that well-known story of the mm-hmm. prodigal son. And then you go outside the U.S. and you tell them to retell the story of the prodigal son. See, one important difference is that people in the U.S. hardly ever mention the drought
mm-hmm.
that took place,
mm-hmm.
whereas people overseas will always mention the drought.
Right.
And that's because that's in their awareness.
They live with it. They're so connected to the ground that if things go bad, they understand how actually bad it can get. And so they read Luke 15 and they're sitting there and they hit that part and they go, we understand how a person could be driven to reconsider the way they're living their life and seeing what's going on because we know what desperate condition that puts us in when we're totally dependent on what the ground produces.
Yeah, yeah. So there is that reading of the text that is impacted by their context as well.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming in and discussing these issues with us. Our hope is that this has been helpful to you in thinking about cultural engagement kind of by looking at it from the outside in. That's mm-hmm. kind of what we've tried to do, and to think about the principles that are involved and the different factors that are involved, and perhaps it's made you pause and think, as it should, all of us, about how to culturally engage in our own context as a result. So, Scott, I appreciate you coming in and doing this. We thank you for joining us at the table, and we look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.